Welcome to Jaipur Bites, the JLF podcast. I'm your host, Laksh Datta. What you're about to hear is a session from day one of Jaipur Lit Fest 2023. And it's called From Dionysus to Vasco da Gama, How Europeans Saw India Before the Age of Exploration. Tom Holland in conversation with William Dalrymple.
Just been made very clear, neither of us are Amir Srinivasan.
No, we're not, I'm relieved to say, going to be talking about sex.
Though if you had been looking at Tom Holland's Twitter feed over the last few days, you would have known the strange discovery he made in Mandu. Tom, will you tell us about your discoveries in Mandu?
Well, Willie, the discovery was made entirely thanks to you. We went to Mandu, and I told Willie that we were going, and Willie informed me that one of the sultans who had lived there had been a leading aphrodisiacist, and he had developed all kinds of ways of perpetuating his sexual energy involving sparrow brains fried in ghee and all kinds of
turmeric,
which
honey.
I haven't actually tried, but who knows? Maybe at some point.
Only your wife in the third row will know the truth of this.
I think, Willie, I think we should change the subject.
So on to Dionysus, which actually isn't that big a change of subject. So Tom, why when you wanted to think about, in a sense, everyone now who's ever passed through university has read Ebu Said and is aware of the whole set of prejudices and ideas that Europeans held about India during the colonial period. But you want to speak today, I think, about the very different, in many ways, set of ideas that Europeans had, and in some ways, though similar.
Well,
in the early period, in the starting with Alexander and Herodotus.
Well, I mean, just to put it in the broadest context to begin with, and this may sound like shameless flattery of an Indian audience, but I think that there is a case...
We'd never descend to those levels, Tom.
I think there is a case for saying that no country, no land in the entire world has been an object of foreign fascination for as long as and across as broad a sweep of land as India. And I think the reason for that is partly that in India, for foreigners, is seen as a land of wonders, a land of extraordinary animals, a land of extraordinary wealth, a land of extraordinary customs. But it's also the geography. India occupies a central position within Eurasia. And so, for the Chinese, who are not famous for being interested in foreign lands, India becomes a place of pilgrimage. They visit it, they write about it. But for Europeans as well, India has always kind of glimmered on the horizon as a land that is fabulously full of wonders, a land that is a contrast to the land of, say, of the Greeks or the Romans or the medieval Europeans, and therefore is all the more fascinating. And I think that...
And more so even than Persia, which is...
I think much more so because... Simply because India is more is further away from Europe and is larger and is richer. And I think that there is a risk in going too far with the Edward Said diagnosis, which is basic, you know, the risk is that you end up saying that any sense of fascination that foreigners feel for a different land is somehow colonialist or imperialist or reductive. I don't think it necessarily is. And I think that in the case of the fascination that the Greeks and the Romans and medieval Europeans felt for India, it is a reflection of the fact that India is, to outsiders, inherently fascinating.
And one of the first legends that reflects this is the legend of Dionysus. Who was Dionysus and where do we read these legends?
So Dionysus is the god of wine, of intoxication, He is said to be followed wherever he goes by admiring hordes of women. So perhaps in one sense, I guess the nearest Indian approximation would be Krishna, would you say?
Or Lord Shiva.
And the story that
the beautiful mendicant is one of the incarnations of Shiva, where he's depicted on temples surrounded by women who can't resist him,
and wild animals and all kinds of things. So the story that the Greeks say is that Dionysus originally comes from India, and he brings with him intoxicants, stimulants, things that you consume that you simply wouldn't get in Greece,
like Sula wine.
Like pseudo white. Well, yes, or say spices. So we know that cinnamon, other spices are being consumed within the Greek world as early as what, 7th century, 8th century, I think?
In the Aegean. Samos.
And so Samos is an island that plays a key role in the story. And it's said that Dionysus turns up in Greece, followed by all these women, with his stimulants and intoxicants, and with lots of wild animals. So he rides a chariot pulled by panthers. And in due course, the animals that come to be particularly associated with Dionysus and his invasion are elephants, which I think for Europeans are the paradigmatic Indian animal. I mean, absolutely. You know, they're colossal, huge creatures, wondrous creatures. And what is fascinating is that on the island of Samos, where, you know, great center of the Indian spice trade, where Dionysus is particularly said to have come, the Greeks find great massive bones that we now know were the fossils of mastodons, prehistoric elephants that are now extinct. But when Greeks looked at these bones, they could recognize that they were actually elephantine. And they identified them as having been the bones of the elephants that had accompanied Dionysus on this great invasion. And so therefore it proved that this was actually true. And as far as I know, this is the earliest example of what we might call paleontological reasoning, looking at fossil bones and comparing them to the bones of living creatures and working out what they actually were.
Brilliant. Brilliant. And so how are these we blithely say Indian spices turn up in a jar in Samos. How do they get there?
Well, that is a huge question that perhaps you've been studying it as well as I have, and we could come on to that perhaps a bit later. Sure. When we look at the origins of trade. But the what you have throughout the Greek period and into the Roman period is people who hear about India and write about it, and it is this weird mixture of things that are clearly fantastical and untrue, things that do seem to be authentic, and things that seem to blur both fact and fantasy. And I guess the paradigmatic figure, the first person who writes about India in any scale in Europe, is the Greek historian Herodotus, who basically invents the genre of history. But he's not just a historian. He's also, I guess you'd call him now, an ethnographer. He's fascinated in the whole sweep of the world. And for Herodotus, again, India is this land on the margins of the East. It's the furthest that you can go eastwards. And he hears about it, I think, because Herodotus is at the western end of a great empire that has India at its eastern end, and that is the Persian Empire.
And he's sitting in what's now Anatolia in
yes.
Turkey.
Yes, so he's an Aegean subject of the Persian king. And so he's hearing these rumors and these whispers about India that are being carried to him by Persians.
And of course, there were bits of South Asia, which are under Persian rule, notably Gandhara and Afghanistan.
And Herodotus says that India contributes more manpower and more wealth to the Persian king than any other single province of the Persian Empire.
And we have descriptions in Herodotus of Indian archers and Indian elephants coming and fighting at Marathon.
But we also have a lot of what I think the technical description would be mad shit. So Herodotus pronounces with a tone of utter confidence that if you fall ill in India, the Indians will eat you, which is why no one ever particularly gets old in India. He claims that Indians copulate in public, And he also said
not necessarily untrue.
And he also says that Indian semen is black, not white. All of which is, you know, he's absolute tone of self-confidence with which he pronounces this. But he does also report
gold digging ants.
So the gold digging ants we'll come to in a minute. But he also says that lots of Indians are vegetarian. And so that, I guess, is true. And he seems to have heard of the Jains, because he says that there are lots of Indians who will do no harm to any living creature at all. And again, he sees this as a fantastically strange thing. But the famous story that, that Herodotus talks about is this story that there are gold-digging ants, and that they're in a desert. They're absolutely huge, about the size of dogs, and that they dig up the sand, and this sand has lots of gold in it. And the Indians go and they
run very fast.
They run very fast. So the Indians go at the absolute heat of the day when the ants are all asleep. They grab the gold and they have to go as fast as they can from the ants because the ants run incredibly fast. So it's a very odd story, and it's always been held up as an example of Herodotus not knowing what he was talking about. But there is a wonderful theory that what Herodotus misattributes to ants may in fact be the Himalayan marmot, which apparently does dig up gold.
And again, those who follow the Holland Tom Instagram, Twitter handle will have seen pictures of marmots
in
Bombay.
Yes. And so I think that...
The Chhatrapati Shivaji Museum.
That Herodotus absolutely exemplifies the way in which you, for Europeans, you get this weird blend of things that are factual and things that aren't, and things that may or may not be. And of course, what changes that for the Greeks and for... Europeans more generally, who are very strongly influenced by Greek scholarship, is of course the invasion of Alexander.
And this again is a complete change. Suddenly you have large numbers of people from Greece actually landing up in what's now Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Yes, and so what Alexander's expedition does for Europeans, it confirms the sense of India as a land of wealth, as a land of wonders. And it introduces a new dimension, which is the gymnosophists, so naked philosophers. And this idea of India as a land of fabulous wisdom, which of course, you know, is still absolutely part of the mainstream in the West. So there is a kind of line that descends from Alexander's fascination with these naked philosophers who he meets in India. He's said to have met right the way down to kind of George Harrison and... all that kind of stuff.
Ravi Shankar.
Yes, Ravi Shankar and the Maharishi and things like that. The idea of India as a land of gurus, of the teaching of wisdom. But I think also the thing that Alexander's invasion does, so the question is that Alexander is supposedly driven by this pothos, this yearning for infinite possibility. And it is said that, you know, he crosses the Indus, he defeats the local king there, and he wants to press on, but the Macedonian soldiers refuse, and so Alexander turns back. And this is the story that's told. But I think it's evident from the reports you get from Greek ambassadors to Indian kings at around the same time, that actually what makes Alexander turn back is that when he arrives in the land of the Indus, he realizes just how vast India is. Greeks, up until that point, had thought that beyond the lands of the Indus was the horizon, and there was nothing else. And so therefore you could reach the limits of the ocean. But Alexander arriving there, I think, realizes, oh God, this is a vast country.
It's going to go on forever.
Yeah. And what that does, I think, is it's a kind of contrast with how Indians themselves see the land of Bharata, the land that the Greeks come to call India after the river Indus. And of course, Chinese pilgrims, and in due course, the communities throughout the Sumatra and Java and so on, is that for peoples in China and the East, India is a land that is defined by its gods and its heroes.
And it's sacred landscape.
Bharata is a sacred landscape. It's a land of holy rivers, of holy mountains, of holy shrines. And whether foreigners in the East are seeing India as the land of the Mahabharata or of Rama or of the Buddha, they are seeing it rather as Indians do, as a land that is defined as sacred. This is not the case for the Greeks. The Greeks interpret it in geographical terms. They draw up lists of its wonders, they draw up lists of its products, when they draw up lists of the rivers, these rivers are not sacred, they are there to be noted so that you can kind of travel along them or visit them. And this, I think, is something that passes into the modern European.
And you don't get, I think, any reference in Indian texts to an idea of Europe. You get Ashoka, for example, knowing about individual Greek kingdoms, but no reference to the idea of a landmass called Europe. But Europeans do have an idea of India as a geographical place.
I may have, you will know much more about this than me, but and tell me if I'm wrong, but I gather, Indians in the ancient world have a sense of India as the kind of southernmost petal of a lotus flower with the Mount Meru at the center. And so in a sense, the lands to the east and the west have a symbolic role in the way that India itself does. They, as far as I know, are not interested in drawing up lists of, you know, describing the Rhine or the product of Spain or anything like that in the way that Greeks and Romans are. And I think that's a really profound difference.
And the Chinese, slightly different again. When Xuanzang, the Chinese pilgrim, turns up at Jalalabad, which he thinks of as the entrance to India, he says, I am just arriving now in India, a region of 70 countries. So he says, a holy land of 70 countries. So he sees it as a holy land. He sees it as a single unit, but politically it's splintered.
Yeah.
By the time he turns up in the 7th century.
Yeah. Whereas I think that for the Greeks, as I said, it's not a holy land, and it is a geographical unit in a way that it will be, say, in due course for the British.
So Alexander goes and dies in Babylon, and his generals divide up his empire, and Seleucids grab the east, the Ptolemies grab Egypt, and you have all these strange Indo-Greek kingdoms for a couple of hundred years with men called sort of Heliocles of the Punjab.
And they're all converting to Buddhism, aren't they?
Diomedes of the Indus, and Taxila and Iconum as major Greek cities with stadiums, with all the things you'd expect to find in a Greek city in the Peloponnese. And then you start having ambassadors like Megasthenes coming, and he has converted to Hinduism. He calls himself a worshipper of a form of Vishnu, and he leaves an inscription. Megasthenes goes to Ashoka's court in Pataliputra.
He goes to Chandragupta, who's the grandfather of Ashoka. And he is the first European to give an eyewitness account of India. We don't actually have the account he wrote of India, but there were lots of excerpts, and so we can kind of piece it together. And we know that he went to Chandragupta's capital, that he was very impressed by it, that he traveled all along the Ganges, and lots of what subsequent Greek and Roman writers are reporting of India comes from him. But as you say, Willie, there are this kingdom is established in the kind of, I suppose, what's now Pakistan, regions of Pakistan and Afghanistan. And you get this kind of fascinating sense of fusion. The Greek kings are starting to cast themselves as defenders of Dharma. Some of them are clearly converting to Buddhism. And actually, what's quite moving is that, in a way, it's the very last, the last independent fragment of Alexander's empire is not Cleopatra's Egypt, as it's often described, but these kingdoms that last up until, I think, the early first century AD, so
exactly
about 50 years after the death of Cleopatra.
And then there's a big change, perhaps even more important than Alexander, because you have the Battle of Actium, Cleopatra is defeated, Antony is defeated, and Augustus absorbs Egypt.
He does.
Into the Roman world. And suddenly you have a single motorway by sea running from the Red Sea coast of Egypt to ports on the Indus, ports in Gujarat, and ports in Kerala.
Yes. So this trade had been established before the Romans annex Egypt. So it's Berenike, isn't it? It's the huge port.
It's a Ptolemaic foundation, and the first boats go backwards and forwards before Actium. But once Rome has now taken over, it turns into 250 vessels a year.
It does. And the thing about Berenike is that it's a deep harbour. And it has to be, because under the Ptolemies, the Greek-Egyptian kings, they're importing elephants. And so you need vast ships to bring the war elephants that the Greek kings need. But you
and
also
a team
have
in Chicago who are digging Berenike now.
Yes.
And they found that the berths for the ships at Berenike are 1.5 times the size of the ones in Alexandria and on the Mediterranean port, because these elephantine elephant transports.
Yeah, they're literally elephantine. Yes. But also you even before the Romans conquer Alexandria, you're starting to have kind of more private enterprise. So what is it? Is it Eudoxus who,
brings singing boys.
Yes.
To Gujarat. Apparently the king of Gujarat is very keen on singing boys.
So he what is it? There's an Indian guy who's been shipwrecked, and Eudoxus rescues him. And there are kind of two, he does two trading trips. So this is early, late second century BC. And he basically tests out the winds. He is clearly doing it with Indian associates, and basically I'm sure not just him, but he's the person who gets associated with this process. Greek traders, Egyptian traders, Roman traders come to realize that actually, if you're using the trade winds and the monsoons effectively, you can get to India and come back pretty efficiently.
It's with a good wind, you can do it in 40 days.
Yes.
But it normally takes a year for the round trip, because you have to wait for the winds to turn around.
And so Eudoxus, interestingly, in the hope that there might be a quicker way, he goes on a voyage through the Pillars of Hercules, so the Straits of Gibraltar, to try and go around Africa.
With his singing boys.
With his singing boys. and then is never heard of again. But of course, this idea of, you know, this dream of getting to India, of a shortcut to India, is one that will haunt Europeans right the way up to the time of Vasco da Gama. But basically, through the first century AD, into the second century, into the third century AD, the volume of trade between the Roman Empire and India is on a stupefying scale. And it's only, I mean, literally, as we're sitting here, the excavations are being done that are opening people's eyes to just how enormous the scale of links were.
So I've just been literally doing this over the last few months, and two important things have turned up in the last few years. Last year, for the first time, in an Isis temple in Berenike, a team of archaeologists from Chicago found the first image of the Buddha found to the west of Afghanistan. So it's a Buddha of a very much Gandharan sort, with sun rays coming out of his head. And he turns up in a storeroom of this Isis temple, along with a whole load of early Hindu gods, pre-Krishna versions of Krishna, and his brother, and also an inscription, a bilingual inscription in Sanskrit and Greek. So this is all kind of brand new stuff. It hasn't been published yet, but it's there being dug by a guy called Steve Sidebottom as we speak. He said. I spoke to him on the phone in the summer, and he's going back now in January, and he said there were other statues poking out of the ground. So this is literally happening.
Yeah, it's so exciting. And so the Romans, they resurrect Berenike, this great elephant port, because again, the size of the freighters bringing stuff are so huge. But also there are further ports higher up the Red Sea that are smaller, that are bringing in jewels and kind of easier stuff to transport.
So the other thing that exciting new discovery is not actually a new discovery, but it's the first time it's been analysed. There's this papyrus, probably from Oxyrhynchus, which is now for some reason in Vienna, and it's called the Musiris Papyrus. And it is a shipping manifest from a Alexandrian Greek, possibly Jewish Greek merchant who owns ships operating out of Berenike. He's sitting in an office in Alexandria. And it's a shipping manifest of a very modern sort, of things that he agrees to buy from a merchant in Kerala, hence Musiris, which is the port of Kerala. And what's astonishing, I've got this here in front of me, what is the value of the stuff? The exports include 4 tons of ivory with a value estimated at 7 million sesterces at a time when a Roman soldier would have earned about 800 sesterces annually and a would-be senator from the cream of aristocracy had to demonstrate assets of 1 million sesterces to be allowed to stand for office. So this one shipment of ivory is worth seven senators' entire worth.
Yeah.
And this is just part of a single shipment on a single boat. It also has 800 boxes of aromatic nard used in perfume, tortoise shell, textiles, probably cotton, which is very valuable. And anyway, this is if you add it all up, the total value of this 150-ton shipment has been calculated as worth 131 talents, enough to purchase 3,000 acres of the best farmland in Egypt.
Yeah.
Or a premium estate in Tuscany. So you can buy, you know, some gorgeous wine estate in Tuscany with this. And a single trading ship, like the one in the Musiris Papyrus, the Hermapolon, could apparently carry several such consignments, each worth this. So Pliny talks about archers being on board to guard all this stuff.
Unsurprisingly.
The total tax paid on this one cargo worth 9 million sesterces was 2 million sesterces. And working up from these figures, they've estimated that Indian imports to Egypt during the Roman period were worth 1 billion sesterces, which the tax authorities in the empire are creaming off 270, which is a revenue that surpasses the revenue of entire countries and could have paid for one third of the entire Roman military budget.
Well, to put it in perspective, I mean, that is more than the total amount that Caesar is said to have looted from Gaul, which enabled him to make himself the greatest man in the Roman Republic. And so what is it that is being imported? Well, certainly there is stuff that is coming even from beyond India. So most obviously silk. So I think that people talk about the silk roads, but actually they should be talking about the silk shipping lanes. The silk, as actually the Romans recognize, they say it's coming from a land of people that they call Ceres, whom they describe as having orange hair and blue eyes. So that's clearly not the Chinese. Or from a mysterious land that they call China. And again, they say, we don't know anything about this land, but this is where the silk is coming from.
And the key point is that it's coming through the
India.
Ports.
It's coming through India. The other stuff, so they are bringing in jewels. Pliny says that India has the best pearls. It has diamonds. So the Emperor Nerva, when he sends a ring to Trajan to appoint him his heir, the ring has a vast diamond from India on it. There's this substance called malabratham, which is key to high-end hair products. So the Vidal Sassoons of ancient Rome needed this stuff.
And Pliny is very pissed off with this stuff, isn't he? Because Pliny
is this sort of puritanical
naval commander who likes everything ship-shape. And he doesn't like Roman women careering around in semi-transparent silks.
No, doesn't approve this at all. And the most famous product, of course, that is being imported is pepper. And the Latin word for that derives from Indian word for it. And
Tamil, in fact.
Tamil word. And Pliny is very disdainful of pepper. He says he doesn't really rate it. But clearly people across the Roman Empire do, right the way up to the most barbarous reaches of the empire in northern Britain. People are obsessed by it. And Pliny is very, very anxious that there is this great drain of gold and silver that is going to India to pay for all of this.
20 years ago, I think in Vindolanda, they found these little receipts surviving in the boggy territory of Hadrian's Wall. And one of those is from a guy called Gabbo, who's just bought 2 denarius worth of pepper sitting on Hadrian's Wall. So you've got this poor Roman peering over at these sort of Scots howling and shrieking over the old Caledonia, over the other side of the painted Picts. And they are, and he's trying to cheer up the miserable cooking of Northumberland with a little bit of Indian pepper.
And so that's where the whole British-Indian relationship begins. Simultaneously, of course, even as Pliny is very aware of the hard economic facts of the relationship between Rome and India, he's still coming out with all this mad stuff. So for Pliny, he writes this huge encyclopedia. It's his ambition to describe the whole world. But when he looks at India, he says it's just too big. There are too many cities. There are too many wonders to describe. Everything about it is supersized. So there are eels that are 300 foot long. The locusts are 3 foot long. The snakes can devour elephants. The jungles are so high that even if you were to shoot an arrow, you wouldn't be able to reach the tops of the trees. All this wondrous stuff. At the same time, there are he reports about what seems to be the caste system, about what seems to be a mention of the practice of suti, the self-immolation of widows. So again, there's this kind of mixture of fact and fiction.
And you're also getting, at the same time, in the early Buddhist viharas, which are now coming along the Bombay coast, Karla and Badger and Bedsa in the Ghats, you're getting pillars and bits of the temple donated by Yavana merchants.
Yeah, so the maybe, Yavana are the maybe Ionians, yeah. So i.e. Greeks. Yeah. Yeah.
And some of them clearly have taken on Buddhism, some clearly haven't.
And I think there's a really interesting indication of just how important the trading relationship becomes for Indians as well as for Romans in a fascinating coin that's been in the news just before Christmas. This was some coins that were found in the 17th century in Romania. And they seem to have been minted in the 3rd century by an emperor called Sponsian, who otherwise is absolutely unheard of. And so it was argued by the people who found these coins that this emperor Sponsian must have been some usurper in the 3rd century when the Roman Empire was tearing itself to pieces, who otherwise no one had heard of. However, when specialists right the way up to the present day have looked at these coins, the consensus has been that they're fakes because firstly, no one's heard of Sponsian. Secondly, the lettering is very, very crude. And thirdly, the image of the emperor on the coin doesn't really correspond to any known portrait of a Roman emperor. And so it's been said that these were early modern or perhaps medieval forgeries. But scientists had looked again at these coins and had demonstrated conclusively that these coins had been underground for a very long time. So evidently they hadn't been faked in the Middle Ages. They must have originated in antiquity. And so this is a real puzzle because on the one hand they seem to be fakes. On the other hand, they do authentically seem to be ancient. And so the latest theory is that they are both ancient and fakes. And in fact, they were faked, their forgeries made in India in the 3rd century. And that Sponsian is a transliteration, a mistransliteration of Gallienus, who was an authentically a Roman emperor, done by someone who didn't read the Latin script. And that these coins were then somehow got back into the Roman Empire.
You also get at the site south of Pondicherry, dug by Mortimer Wheeler, you also get Indians faking intaglios. So yeah. You have the same sort of thing, sort of fake Louis Vuitton bags appearing in the Delhi bazaars. These guys are faking Roman intaglios, which they can make cheaply and then sell as Roman. Both East and West, do they turn up in Thailand and in Cambodia?
So I think the Sponsian coin is a kind of monetary equivalent of that.
Love it.
And it reflects the way that the relationship between the Roman Empire and India is simultaneously very, very intimate. These trade links are, you could call it a kind of early example of globalization, but at the same time, certainly for the Romans, India remains a land of romance and glamour. And the archetypal emperor who dreams of visiting India is the Emperor Trajan, who is visited by ambassadors, it's reported by Roman historians, from India. He invades the Parthian Empire, he reaches the Persian Gulf, and when he reaches the Persian Gulf, he sees an Indian ship sailing away. The report is, as he stood beside the ocean and was briefed about his nature, he saw a ship departing for India. "I should certainly have crossed to India myself," he commented, "if only I had been younger." Whereupon he felt contemplation of the Indians and expressed curiosity as to how they conducted their affairs. And he reckoned Alexander to have been a lucky man.
I love it.
So you have all this, wealth, yearning, Alexander, trade, all that nexus is exemplified in that story. And it's something that when the Roman Empire in the West falls, trading links between Byzantium continue, trading links between the Islamic world, of course, continue. But in the West, it becomes much, in Western Europe, it becomes much harder. trading links do persist. So in what becomes post-Roman Gaul, the Merovingian kings, the Frankish kings, they are making grants of pepper to monasteries. And the Anglo-Saxons, they love their riddles. So here is an Anglo-Saxon riddle. See if you can guess it. I am black on the outside, covered with wrinkled skin, yet inside I have a glistening core. I season the delicacies of the kitchen, the feasts of kings and extravagant dishes, and likewise sauces and stews. But you will find me of no value unless my inwards are crushed for their shining contents, which pepper. Is pepper. Yeah. So pepper is familiar enough to the English in the early Middle Ages that you can make jokes about it.
And King Alfred sends the first English expedition to India, probably.
He does. So this is a mention in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. Again, I'll read it. In the year 883, which is the year that Alfred captures London from the Vikings, Sighelm and Athelstan took to Rome and also to St. Thomas in India and to St. Bartholomew, the arms which King Alfred had vowed to send there when they besieged the raiding army in London. And there, by the grace of God, they were very successful in obtaining their prayers in accordance with these vows. Now, it has been argued that perhaps India is a mistransliteration for Judea, i.e. Judea, Palestine, but I don't think it is, because both Thomas and Bartholomew are saints who were believed to have been martyred in India, in southern India, in Kerala. And we have records of people going to the shrine of St. Thomas. It was reported in medieval Europe that there was a lamp there that never went out. It was kind of miraculously always alight.
Gregory of Tours mentions it, yes.
And so I think that Sighelm and Athelstan going there in 883, these are the first named Englishmen
to come
to India.
And they're after a spiritual thing.
They're after this. They're not after wealth. They're there to pay their respects to the shrine of St. Thomas.
So just quickly to wind us, we had to get up in three minutes to Vasco da Gama. Yeah. So between Sighelm and Vasco, what happens? We got the Arabs coming in, taking over the Islam rises up, takes over Persia, takes over as far as the Indus.
Yes, so unlike the Romans, for whom the Mediterranean and the Red Sea was very much theirs to do with as they pleased, the emergence of the caliphate of Muslim lands who are ideologically opposed to the Christians of Western Europe means that it becomes much, much harder for European states to have access to India. And so the fruits of those are twofold. The first is that knowledge of India diminishes very, very decisively. And Europeans are dependent basically on all the batshit crazy stuff that Pliny and everybody else had reported.
One of the interesting things from an Indian perspective is that when all this gold from Rome ceases to be turning up, because the Indians are making a massive fortune from this, and Pliny is worried because all the gold from Rome is
leaching out
into India. That stops once the Arabs come. And so Indians at this point begin looking eastwards to Cambodia, Thailand, Java. And this is exactly the period that you begin to get Sanskrit, Hinduism and Buddhism appearing to the east, because the Indian merchants are leading this and they are trading eastwards because they're not getting the money anymore from the West.
Although obviously, I mean, the Arabs continue the trade, and in a way the stories of Sinbad, lots of those are set in India. Lots of the Arabian Nights are set in India.
And the Abbasids are importing stuff from China and from India.
Yes, and of course in due course, the Islamic empires of Persia will be hugely influential on India. But for Europeans, India becomes ever more a land of fable and wonder. And I guess by the 12th century, basically the role that India plays in the European imagination is as a land that is the opposite of Europe.
You get a few travellers still. Marco Polo stops in at Madras.
Right.
And he goes to see St. Thomas too.
And so the coming of the Mongols, who established this vast Eurasian empire, that does make it India more accessible. And so you do start to get an acceleration of trade links again. And of course, this then serves to open the eyes of Europeans to how much wealth there is in India, how many products India has that they want, and how infuriating it is that a load of infidels are occupying all the trade links. And so this dream that Eudoxus had initially pursued of trying to find a shortcut to India is one that people on the western seaboard of Europe, and particularly the Portuguese, really start to develop. And so in the 15th century, you start to get Portuguese adventurers going down the coastline of Africa, rounding the Cape of Good Hope.
Getting involved in slave trade.
Involved in slave trade, getting up to all kinds of nonsense. And in the end, with Vasco da Gama arriving in Calicut. So Vasco da Gama makes three voyages to Kerala. And when he turns up, he pays his respect to the local king. And the king says, okay, well, what have you got for me? And Vasco da Gama hands over the greatest produce of Europe. And the king of Calicut laughs in his face and says, well, this is junk. This is absolute rubbish. Is this all you've got? And so Vasco da Gama
shells Calicut.
He basically turns a bit feral.
He also goes to look for a church.
He does, yes.
And mistakes an image of Lakshmi for the Virgin Mary. And he can't understand why she's so voluptuous.
But basically, I mean, the Portuguese have it, you know, it's brought home to them how they are of no interest to the kings of India.
At all.
They're poor, they're backward, they don't really have anything to offer. But of course, what the Portuguese do have, and indeed the Europeans who will follow, is an incredible ability at violence.
And gunpowder,
large ships.
Yeah.
And so the Portuguese start establishing forts along the line of India.
And shell Calicut, the Zamorin's palace goes up in flames.
Yeah. And Vasco da Gama commits a terrible atrocity on a pilgrim ship that's been going from Kerala to Mecca, where he locks all the pilgrims up and burns them to death. And this is, so...
You wouldn't want to take Vasco da Gama back to meet
your parents. You wouldn't. And so I think that what's interesting about this in the context of everything that had gone before is that this, it's the violence that enables the Portuguese to crowbar their way into Indian affairs. But that sense of India as simultaneously a land of wonder and of wealth is also very much a part of it. The Portuguese, and then in due course the Dutch and the English and the French, when they turn up, and of course they're there to make money, and of course they impose themselves violently, but they are not, I think, solely there about the loot, although the loot is obviously very important. That sense of India as a land that is inherently fascinating, that is inherently worth visiting, where you go to gawp and to wonder at what India has, which is an inheritance through the Middle Ages of the classical writers, I think that is also a part of it. And I think that in a way that is, you know, the fact that we as Europeans are sitting here in India talking
gawping
about the fascination of India, that in that sense we are, well, I like to think that we are the heirs of Herodotus to that degree at least.
Not Vasco da Gama, thankfully.
No, not Vasco da Gama. So I don't think that Europeans being fascinated by India is necessarily colonialist, at least I hope it's not.
Ladies and gentlemen, a big round of applause for Tom Holland.
Thank you.
Europe's most popular podcaster.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Jepper Bytes. I'm your host, Laksh Datta. This podcast is produced by Launchora in association with Teamwork Arts. Please follow or subscribe to this show wherever you're listening to this to be notified about new episodes.